I was told in college that humans are little more than specks of dust in an immense cosmos. My next guests argue that new technologies may give us ways in which we can interpret what our human place in the cosmos really is, allowing us to see a new scientific picture of life in which we turn out to be special creatures and that our place in the universe is central. Nancy Ellen Abrams is a cultural philosopher and lecturer, and her husband Joel R. Primack is a professor of physics and astronomy. Both are at the University of California, and their latest book is called The New Universe and the Human Future. It's published by Yale University Press. I'm very pleased that it brings them back to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having us back.
We often talk about the creation myths of various cultures and religions, but hasn't the science of cosmology come up with a long history of creation myths over the years?
Well, you can call them that, although the difference is that scientifically based stories are not exactly the same sort of thing as the traditional creation myths. One of the differences is that traditional creation myths put human, the human soul and humanity as a whole, right in the center of the story. And we scientists, at least in our professional capacity, usually treat the universe as something distinct from our own humanity. And we humans are outside looking in, if you like. On the other hand, it's also true that the scientific stories are based on increasingly large amounts of observational data. And we now can get a scientific consensus on the scientific picture of the origin and evolution of the universe, something that was never possible on the mythical level.
Well, Nancy, you teach philosophy. Are you upset that the scientists have taken over this thing from the philosophers and the theologians?
Not at all.
But it's been largely the province of those areas until fairly recently.
But they couldn't
recently.
Make any progress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, unless we have new metaphors, a whole new way of understanding the universe, we can't make any progress on what's called perennial questions. They're perennial because they're based on opinion rather than knowledge. And this new picture of the universe is a huge breakthrough. It's the first picture humanity has ever had in our entire history that could actually be true. And this is an opportunity for the human race. So people should recognize it as that. If enough people actually caught on to what this picture meant, it could be a very unexpected ticket to a sustainable world, because it teaches us for the first time how to really think big and for the very long term. And this is just the perspective that the world really needs in order to start getting a handle on global
problems.
Well,
when you say new picture of the universe, how new are we talking about? Starting with the realization that there was a Big Bang? No,
that's been known since the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've known that the universe is expanding.
The fact that the universe is expanding quicker, is that when all
no,
of this begins?
No, what's new about it is that now we have a picture of how the whole entire universe operates, what it's made of. No one, I'd say the picture probably dates from 1998 when the observational data came in that confirmed the idea that dark energy exists and that the universe is expanding faster and faster. That's probably, so it's not an old picture. We're talking just, a decade.
Now, we know for sure dark energy exists. I always thought that it was just a construct of scientists to explain what they couldn't explain.
Well, I think it's important to understand that what we know is that the vast majority of the universe is invisible, and that it's made of a combination of two different kinds of invisible stuff, which we call dark matter and dark energy. Of that, I don't think there's any doubt. The evidence is simply overwhelming. It's also true that we don't know yet what either of these things is. We don't know the identity of the dark matter. We think it's very likely to be some kind of elementary particle that we haven't been able to make yet in our laboratories on Earth, although we hope to be able to start making it soon at the Large Hadron Collider. And as to the dark energy, we even know less. But we do know enough about how they behave that we can put that into our supercomputer simulations and our theoretical calculations. And the agreement between the latest calculations and everything that we observe is absolutely spectacular. I think a lot of people probably haven't appreciated that the predictions of the theory are surprising and extremely detailed. For example, the analysis of the cosmic background radiation and its structure on different angular scales gives rise to curves with many wiggles. And the data has now come in, and 9 different wiggles predicted by the theory are observed in great detail, and there's not a single shred of evidence that contradicts the theory on any large scales.
But until just recently, there was no evidence that contradicted Einstein's idea that nothing could move faster than the speed of light. And now, at least some scientists claim to have observed it. Others are still questioning whether that actually was true.
So this is an experiment called OPERA. It's an Italian experiment, although there's an international cast of about 160 scientists involved. And yes, their preliminary oral report at the European Center for Nuclear Research in Geneva said that they have a very small disagreement with relativity, a part in 10 to the fifth. But still, any disagreement with relativity is catastrophic because this theory is the basis for, among other things, our picture of the large-scale structure and evolution
of
the universe.
So we still don't know.
Well, you have to understand, science is always provisional. The knowledge that we have in science is always subject to revision, and if this experiment turns out to have correctly determined that there's a violation of relativity, we're going to have to rethink everything. However, it's also important to understand that that was apparently a premature announcement by the Italian group, and the latest report is that the entire group got together and decided that they're not yet ready to submit their paper for publication. They want to do a series of checks that they probably should have done before they made this announcement. In any case, there are 2 independent groups, one in the United States, the other in Japan, that can do the same experiment. And I understand that over the next 6 months or so, we're going to get independent confirmations or not. There are some very good theoretical arguments that suggest that this Italian experiment must be wrong. If it's really true that neutrinos travel faster than light, even by a tiny amount, that shows that that implies that electrons also must travel faster than the speed of light by an even smaller amount because they're only neutrinos part of the time. But we have data from multiple independent experiments that show that this isn't true for electrons. And so that's an indirect argument that the neutrino observation must be wrong.
The last time you were on the show was 5 years ago when The View from the Center of the Universe, your previous book, was published. And after reading that book, didn't Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy list you, Joel, as one of the 2 non-lawyers he'd like to see appointed to the Supreme Court?
That absolutely astonished me.
Would you vote with him most of the time?
Well, Anthony Kennedy is the swing vote on the Supreme Court. And when he votes with the liberals, I'm always delighted. And when he writes opinions like Americans United, saying basically opening the door for unlimited campaign contributions that are secret, I think I was appalled.
Well, Nancy, that book was based on a popular course called Cosmology and Culture that the two of you started teaching at UC Santa Cruz in 1995, but wasn't it canceled because of cutbacks? Aren't you fighting an uphill battle then?
Well, we're not fighting with the University of California anymore. Their budgetary problems are really beyond anybody's solution at this point. Yes, our course was cut, but then every non-required course was cut. So we were not singled out by any means.
Well, the title suggests that there is a link between cosmology and culture. Is there?
Absolutely, there's a link. And
cosmology is what? The
cosmology
explanation
is
the creation of the universe and how it works?
Yes. Although historically, I mean, if you look at it from the point of view of an anthropologist rather than of an astrophysicist, a cosmology is a culture's picture of the reality behind the visible. Everything. It's how the gods work. It's what the gods expect of us. It's how the universe came about. It's how we fit in and what we are expected to do to live a proper life. All of that is the cosmology of a culture. And what cosmology means today is it's basically taken on the astrophysicist's definition, which is a scientific description of the origin and evolution of the large-scale structure of the universe. Now, there's some overlap here. And what Joel and I are trying to do is to say that our Western culture, I mean, it's more than the West, it's really the modern world, doesn't have a cosmology that we share by the definition of earlier cultures. We have no picture of reality that we share, but we do have this amazing new story of the universe, and what Joel and I are trying to do is to interpret that in such a way that we have a science-based picture of reality.
But I remember that book, and you repeat it here, you argued that humans enjoy a privileged place in the cosmos. And isn't that something that leaves you fairly alone in the philosophical world?
I don't really care if I'm alone in the philosophical world. I only care if I'm right. And, you know, Einstein said the same thing. I mean, he was apparently the Nazis put together a book with 100 physicists who all argued that Einstein was wrong. And Einstein said, if I were wrong, one physicist would have been enough. So, frankly, it doesn't matter what other people think. What matters is that we have this huge opportunity, and we have an opportunity to translate this modern picture of cosmology into a picture that can inspire us, I think, and motivate us to make the kind of changes in the world that we need to make, because we need to cooperate on a much wider scale than humans have ever cooperated before. We need some common ground.
My guests are Nancy Ellen Abrams and Joel R. Primack. Their book, The New Universe and the Human Future, published by Yale University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We will take a little break, and we'll come back with more right after this. We're back with Nancy Ellen Abrams, who's an attorney, philosopher of science, and a lecturer. And Joel R. Primack, Distinguished Professor of Physics and Astronomy, both of them at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Their latest book is called The New Universe and the Human Future, How a Shared Cosmology Could Transform the World. It is published by Yale University Press. And that shared cosmology would require everyone to go along, wouldn't it? Would that be possible? Because when we talk about this sort of thing with religious people, they have their own cosmology, don't they? Or at least fundamentalists do?
First of all, it does not require everyone to go along, because there will never be an idea in humanity, hopefully, that everybody agrees on. But what we really need is an option for people who are really concerned about the future of the planet, who are not restricted by scriptural stories in their thinking, and who are willing to really commit to saving the conditions on this earth that we need. We need a group like that, and I believe that culture is really led by maybe only 10% of the people. That's really all we need. And it's very important to have a picture that we know is equally true for everyone and that can change as we learn. And that's what this modern cosmology gives us.
You say that those of us alive today may be the most significant generation, because we have a better understanding of how things have worked, because we know about the Big Bang
and
the expansion of the universe.
It's because humanity is going to have to go through a remarkable transition over the next generation. We have been, ever since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in 1800, we've been increasing our use of natural resources, doubling about every 30 years. And this is partly because of the growth of population, but also because of the tremendous increase in the use of resources per capita. This process has now reached a scale where we are affecting the entire planet. One of the ways that we've disturbed this is through the growth of greenhouse gases, especially carbon dioxide, where we have actually increased the amount of carbon dioxide in the entire atmosphere of the Earth by more than 30%.
Now, Professor Primack, every time this comes up, every time a scientist says this on the show, I get at least two or three people, listeners, saying, we have more scientists saying that that's not true.
Well, I don't think the question of the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is the least bit controversial. It's been measured independently.
It's whether humans are responsible for it.
No, I don't think that's controversial either, because we
Isn't
know.
Isn't that what people in Congress are saying?
Well, it's true that there's a number of people that basically are trying to preserve the status quo, including the increased use of fossil fuels, and they're basically denying the science. But I don't think that there's disagreement in the scientific community. In fact, the UN is about to release the fourth report of the big UN program on climate change, and that's going to say that the vast majority of scientists, at least 99% of the relevant scientists, agree on what I'm saying. I don't think that there's really any disagreement. I mean, the amount of scientific consensus on this is truly remarkable.
So the universe would go on for billions more years, but we may not be here if we continue in our the ways we've been conducting ourselves.
Well, if we continue to increase the amount of carbon dioxide at the rate that we have in the past, this 30%, this doubling rather every 30 years, that corresponds to an increase of a factor of 8 in the present century. That would be an increase in the total carbon dioxide content of the Earth's atmosphere by a factor of several. And it would lead to an increase in global temperature that's perhaps 5 to 10 times greater than the increase we've had since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. This would cause catastrophic climate change. For example, there's already a poleward march of the climate zones. That is to say that the traditional climates of the temperate zone in the United States are moving toward the poles, and the climate zones across the United States are going to be like those that are traditionally associated with regions much closer to the equator. This means that the trees across the country are going to die because they can't move, and we're going to have an entire replacement of all the flora and therefore all the fauna, which includes, incidentally, tropical diseases. And the same changes are going to occur across the world, and they're going to affect especially regions that are near the sea and subject to the increase in sea level. We're already seeing catastrophic effects in South Asia with all of the flooding in Thailand, for example.
So who do we have to convince most, the people who make policy or the rest of the people in the world that we have to change our ways?
Well, I think we have to convince both. But in general, I think we find that the governments are usually followers rather than leaders. It's very rare that we get that we're fortunate enough to have governments that are wise and are real leaders in areas like this. And I think the most important thing is to convince the people to elect better leaders.
You write that we as humans are central or special in surprising ways. Can you give us three reasons why we're special?
Sure. Many people think that what we humans are is insignificant motes tossed into a vast and hostile universe. We're very small. But if you understand all of the size scales in the universe, if you understand the range of sizes that's possible, and that's from the Planck length all the way up to the size of the visible universe, you discover that human beings are right in the middle. We are central. Our bodies are central in size. And we couldn't be anywhere else because we have to be made of enough atoms to be really complex in order to have our consciousness. But we can't be so big that internal communications are limited by the speed of light. We're so small compared to the speed of light that our thinking is practically instantaneous. So there's this sweet spot in the middle of sizes, and probably any intelligent aliens, if they do exist, are approximately our size. I don't mean, 5 feet tall, but I mean somewhere between a redwood tree and a puppy. That's the range. So we're central in size. We are made of the rarest material in the universe, which is stardust. It's the dust that is blown out of stars when they explode at the end of their lives.
But everything on Earth is made of stardust.
Exactly.
Animal, vegetable, and mineral.
Our planet is made of stardust, and stardust is only 1/10,000th of the content of the universe. So we're in this sort of magical concentration of stardust. I'm not trying to say that that we're different from other aliens. What I'm trying to say is that we need to appreciate the specialness of our place in the context of the whole universe. When you understand how different the universe is from Earth and from life here, you begin to appreciate how important we are. And then, of course, the third reason is that we're living in the middle of time on multiple size scales.
Can you explain what that means?
Well, we're living at this very special time when the universe has begun to accelerate its expansion because the dark energy is taking over.
But it hasn't been accelerating all along? This is something that just happened fairly recently?
Yes, that's right. So for the first two-thirds of the time since the Big Bang, the universe was slowing down.
As we would expect after an explosion.
Right.
Things go out and in time they just slow down.
Because of gravity. But as the universe has become less and less dense, the property of space itself, which seems to be a large part of what the dark energy is, as the amount of space has grown compared to the amount of matter in the space, the dark energy is taking over. And on a time scale that's fairly short cosmically, the distant galaxies are going to disappear, and our ability to understand the whole structure and evolution of the universe will disappear with them.
They're not going to disappear. We just won't be able to see them anymore.
That's what disappear means.
But they'll still be there.
They'll be there, but if it weren't for the records that we and our near-term descendants are going to leave, our distant descendants would never know about them. And then similarly, we live at a very special time for Earth. We're living at a time when Earth is making this transition, first on a fairly long-term scale, as the sun heats up, as all stars of its type do, and then on a much shorter time scale of this transition of humanity, where humanity is going to have to, if we're going to survive, make a smooth and basically benevolent transition from our very exponential, our very, very rapid growth in our use of resources and our impacts on the Earth to a sustainable long-term trend.
Although we've always trusted in technology to get us through, you're kind of suggesting here that we better start thinking in other ways as well.
Well, we're going to need everything that we can, new technology, but also a completely new level of human cooperation.
Mary Ellen Abrams and Joel Primack will be giving a talk at the Hayden Planetarium tonight at 7:30. For ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. Their latest book is called The New Universe and the Human Future, How a Shared Cosmology Could Transform the World. It is published by Yale University Press. And it has been a great pleasure to talk with you today. Of course, we couldn't get to everything, but that's why people read books, right?
Well, we certainly hope so. Thanks very much for having us.
On tomorrow's show, Harvey Arreton reminds us about the glory days of the New York Knicks in the 60s and 70s, the time when people actually played basketball professionally. Then singer, dancer, actress Jane Powell joins TCM host Robert Osborne to talk about a new Furman Gallery exhibit of movie posters. Also, Nathan Myhrvold on compiling modernist cuisine, a huge six-volume, 2,400-page collection on the revolutions in science of cooking. And we'll also speak with Mary Gabriel on Karl Marx's Marriage. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, Melissa Eganzi, executive producer. We had help today from John Maria Giuliani, Christina Maldonado, Sarah Waltuck. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.